Hello, I'm Christine, and welcome to this week's edition of the Black Country Talking News for the 20th of August 2025. Hello, and welcome to the Black Country Talking News, brought to you by the sight loss charity Beacon. We're pleased to confirm that the Talking News is now available via Alexa. Once you've enabled the Talking Newspapers skill, all you need to do is play Talking Newspapers and ask for the Black Country Talking News. Our Talking News service is also available via the free Wireless for the Blind app. It can be found on the Beacon Centre website, www.beaconvision.org/talking-news. As a podcast via services such as Apple or Spotify, or as a free CD, simply contact Beacon Centre on 01902 880 111. We hope you enjoy this week's edition. Reading for you this week, we have myself, Christine, Angela, Helen, Mohammed, Mina, Simon and Roger. In this week's edition, we have all the latest from Beacon with Helen and Mohammed. We have plenty of information and nostalgia with all the latest news from the Black Country. To mark the 80th anniversary of VJ Day, we honour our most brave by sharing some stories and legacies of heroism and courage. With an emotional curtain raiser at Molyneux remembering former favourite Diogo Jota, we look back at all the weekend's football action for both West Brom and Wolves. You'll have to be sharp of mind as we have another challenging quiz from Roger. We hit the tracks again as we continue our railway adventure with Talking News contributor and railway enthusiast David Smith. There sure has been plenty of summer sunshine about this week. How long will it last? Are things set to get a little more unsettled? It is a bank holiday weekend after all. We hear from Mina, who has the forecast for the week ahead. And with thanks to the gardening experts at MK Pulse magazine, from herb and vegetable harvesting to ponds and early planting for the winter, we have all the latest hints and tips for August in the garden. Local news to start though with me, Christine and Angela.
Digital technology used to deliver better patient care, boost productivity and streamline services at the Royal Wolverhampton NHS Trust has received government praise. Peter Carr, Secretary of State for Science, Innovation and Technology, joined West Midlands Mayor Richard Parker and Councillor Stephen Simpkins, leader of Wolverhampton Council, at New Cross Hospital last Wednesday to see how innovation is changing lives and supporting the NHS. Dr. Yat Lee, consultant anaesthetist and chief clinical information officer at the Trust, spoke about its use of artificial intelligence, AI, to speed up administration processes to provide better patient care, with Mr. Carl and Mr. Parker also able to try out the technology and see how it works. He demonstrated ClearNotes, which operate by listening to doctor-patient conversations during a consultation and automatically generate a structured discussion summary, significantly reducing paperwork for clinicians. He said ClearNotes has improved clinic letter turnaround times from up to a week to just 1 to 2 days and increased productivity by 25% in one clinic, all while maintaining high standards of clinical safety and governance. We also use MyPreOp, which is an online preoperative assessment questionnaire that allows patients to fill in an assessment at home before their procedure. This reduces hospital visits and helps the patient be fit for surgery. Mr. Carl said he was very impressed by what he had seen and said it showed the innovation in the NHS as well as the impact it will have on people. He said, "It's incredible because you get a sense of how much impact it has on people, and we are standing in a room which is completely filled with machinery and technology, but never forget that at the heart of it is people. Because of this machinery, people will come in and will have a surgical experience where the incision will be smaller, the procedure will be faster, and the time in which they will get home will be more rapid than ever before. Secretary of State for Science, Innovation and Technology Peter Carr and Mayor of the West Midlands Richard Parker visited New Cross Hospital in Wolverhampton to learn more about how they're using robotics to improve patient care. I can never wrap my head around what it is surgeons do and how they do it, and the sheer amount of skill that it takes to go into someone's body and do what they do to make us better again. But to see the harmony with which surgeons are now working with technology and robotics, also involving AI, is quite extraordinary. I would have absolute confidence if I were ever in a situation of being able to benefit from this technology, and that is why I have a real sense of urgency, alongside the Health Minister and the Prime Minister, to get this technology out there, benefiting everyone from every background in every part of our country. The hospital has two Da Vinci Xi robots working every week on cases in neurology, colorectal, cardiothoracic and gynecology surgery. Compared to traditional keyhole surgery, robotic surgery allows greater dexterity and is easier to manipulate as the instruments are controlled by a surgeon at a console using a 3D camera. Richard Parker, Mayor of the West Midlands, said, "Health tech is about better care for patients, shorter waiting times and more good jobs here in the West Midlands. I think it's fantastic technology, leading edge technology, and we've talked with the surgeons about the precision surgery that this robot can perform and is improving the care of patients, improving their recovery times and driving efficiencies. Through my growth plan, we are making this one of the best places in the country to develop and roll out new treatments, from expanding our innovation clusters to supporting local medtech businesses to grow and export. The technology I've seen today is proof that when we back science, patients and the economy both win." Councillor Simpkins said, "I was absolutely blown away with the visit today. The sky is the limit with the potential there is using this fantastic technology in the NHS, not just for patient care, but also providing jobs in the city."
And 1 year on from an innovative healthcare project opening their doors, Cygnet Hospital Wolverhampton and Cygnet Hospital Oldbury have transformed access to specialist mental health care in the West Midlands, supporting nearly 300 men and women on their journey to recovery. Cygnet Hospital Wolverhampton, based on Wolverhampton Road, is a 29-bed service offering a psychiatric intensive care unit, PICU, and acute service for men. Since August 2024, Cygnet Hospital Wolverhampton has supported over 180 men and achieved 92% successful outcomes for those discharged from its Carter Ward acute service. On average, men in Carter Ward stayed for just 28 days before progressing on their path to recovery. The service also earned outstanding feedback from patients and families, with consistent 5-star ratings on Google, with comments including, "It almost feels like a miracle. I am more than confident that I will recover." Lottie Martin, hospital manager, said, "Reflecting on our first year, I am proud of the team's commitment to delivering the best possible care. I look forward to continuing our work together, bringing an even greater impact to the men we support, their families, and the wider community." At Cygnet Hospital Oldbury, staff have supported more than 110 women in the past year. The 27-bed hospital, located on Salop Drive, includes a 12-bed PICU and 15-bed acute ward. On Emmeline Ward, the acute service, 88% of women were able to move on to a new care pathway, supported by a focus on safe, timely transitions. Families praised the service for the impact it has had on their loved ones, with comments such as, "We're grateful for the support provided to my sister to aid her recovery. Staff have been kind and responsive when we needed updates." Stephen Smith, hospital manager, said, "I'm immensely proud of our entire team and all their achievements in the last year. The teamwork I've witnessed has been nothing short of inspiring. From our incredible nurses and doctors to our dedicated administrative and support staff, every single person plays a vital role in our success. It's this collaborative working that allows us to provide exceptional care." Both hospitals were officially opened in summer 2024 by the Mayor of Wolverhampton, Councillor Linda Leach, helping people access care closer to home and family support networks. Together, they have created over 200 jobs for local people across a range of roles, from clinical positions to catering, domestic and administrative work. Signet has also invested further in the local economy, using West Midlands-based contractors during the construction phase and sourcing local suppliers for day-to-day operations. With facilities including landscaped gardens, ensuite bedrooms, therapy and treatment rooms, multi-faith spaces, gyms, communal lounges and quiet areas, both hospitals provide safe, comfortable environments designed to promote recovery and independence.
This month has also seen the City of Wolverhampton Council launch a new survey inviting parent carers, young people and professionals to share their views on special educational needs and disabilities SEND services in the city. Feedback will play a vital role in evaluating the effectiveness of current services and support, understanding how well the Wolverhampton SEND local area partnership is meeting the needs of children and young people with SEND and their families, and shaping future improvement plans to make services more inclusive, responsive and impactful. The survey is structured around the 13 key areas of the National SEND and Inclusion Inspection Frameworks, which assesses how effectively education, health and social care services work together to support children and young people. The survey is available at Wolverhampton SEND Local Area Partnership until Saturday the 27th of September, and all responses will be treated confidentially. Councillor Jackie Coogan, Cabinet Member for Children, Young People and Education, said the Wolverhampton SEND Local Area Partnership is committed to improving outcomes for children and young people with SEND, including those in alternative provision. And to do this, we need to listen to the voices of our families, young people and professionals. Your feedback is essential in helping us understand what's working well and where we can improve further. I would strongly encourage everyone with experience of SEND services in Wolverhampton to take part in this survey, so that together we can build a more inclusive and supportive future for our children and young people. For more information about SEND services in Wolverhampton, visit SEND Local Offer at www.localofferwolves.co.uk.
Up next, we have the Beacon Update, brought to us by Mohammed.
Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Beacon Update. My name's Mohammed, and I've got the latest for you from everything that's been happening here at Beacon this week. School uniform donation sale on Thursday, the 21st of August. Looking for affordable school uniforms? Come along to our school uniform sale at the Beacon Centre for the Blind. Uniforms from Cotwell End School and the Strait School will be available on a donation basis. Pay what you can and support a great cause. At Beacon Charity Shop, Wolverhampton Road East, WV4 6AZ, all proceeds go directly to supporting the incredible work of the Beacon Centre for the Blind. Let's make a difference together. Next up, this week we've had some exciting community activities we want to highlight. We've had tandem cycling, a cooking session where we cooked a tasty lasagna, and swimming. More activities are available to view on the website. That's it for this week's Beacon Update. Join me again next week, where I will have even more about everything that's been going on at Beacon.
Thanks for that update, Mohammed. Next up, we have another block of local news.
Thousands of Wolves fans have been paying homage at a new mural painted in memory of former Wolves player Diogo Jota. The 28-year-old and his younger brother Andre Silva, also a talented footballer, were tragically killed in Spain on July 3rd in a car crash. After that, Wolves fan and artist Joe Miles set up an online appeal for help to create a fitting tribute to his memory in Wolverhampton. The popular forward played for Wolverhampton Wanderers from 2017 to 2020 before moving to Liverpool, with whom he won the Premier League just months before his untimely death. The beautiful old gold and black picture on a wall in the grounds of popular pub The Leaping Wolf is now complete. After attracting fans' support, Joe of Birmingham joined forces with the pub's bosses and other businesses to make the dream a reality. Enough funds were collected towards the cost of the paint, while Smethwick-based firm Summit Platforms donated mechanical lifts so Joe, of Artwork by Joe, could work safely at height. Ahead of Saturday's August 16th season opener and 4-0 defeat to Manchester City, streams of fans made the pilgrimage to the pub off Waterloo Road near Molyneux to view the completed giant artwork for themselves. Among them was Stafford retailer John Thurley, aged 66, who said, "Players like Diogo Jota come along once in a lifetime. His death was a great tragedy for his family and for the game. We think the artist has done a really good job. That's exactly how he looked." Retired pub landlord Alan Jordan, aged 73, also of Stafford, said, "The mural is brilliant. It's brilliant how quickly they've done it, and it's going to be on the wall forever. He was a brilliant player. His name used to ring out at every game." Inside Molyneux and Wolves also paid tribute to Diogo Jota and his younger brother André Silva prior to their Premier League opener against Manchester City on Saturday evening. Ahead of the first competitive fixture since their tragic passing, the tributes were large, visible and shared with a global audience at Sky Sports Live 5:30pm kickoff. Among the most striking tributes was a tifo of the former Wolves favourite, a choreographed display in which fans of Molyneux's South Bank held up an enormous gold and black banner spanning right up to the stanchions of the stand. The banner captured Jota celebrating with his arms outstretched with the words, "We'll remember you when you walk in fields of gold," at the bottom. Jota's favourite song, Fields of Gold by Sting, from which the words were taken, was also played out around the stadium, prompting emotional scenes at Molyneux. Jota's parents were in attendance to see the tribute, along with Jota's wife, Rute Cardoso, former Wolves player Ruben Neves, and his international manager, Roberto Martinez. The TIFO project has been led by supporter group Old Gold Pack, who have been fundraising over the past month to honour Diogo. Thanks to generous donations from Wolves fans and the wider football community, co-founder Kieran Newey and his team have created a tribute designed to resonate both inside Molyneux and with those watching around the world. "We wanted to honour Diogo and show what he meant to Wolves fans and to Wolverhampton," said Newey. "Football fans come together at times like this to really show the true love they have for players and for football clubs. And we've had donations from across football, but Wolves fans in particular. Diogo was one of the legends who helped turn the club around when we really needed it. We wanted to show his family and everyone who loved him exactly what he meant to us. It's going to be emotional for everyone in the stadium and watching at home, but we believe we'll get it right." Following the tragedy, the Billy Wright statue became a powerful focal point for fans to pay their respects, and all non-perishable items from that display were carefully stored, with a selection to be displayed permanently in the Wolves Museum. Floral tributes were also collected, and selected blooms are currently being turned into ink for a future artistic tribute, while the remaining flowers were composted to help nurture green spaces at Compton Park and Molyneux.
Across the region, and the Mary Stevens Hospice is delighted to announce the launch of a new postbox, Whisper on the Wind. Located in the grounds of the Mary Stevens Hospice, the postbox offers a connection for those who are grieving by inviting individuals of all ages to write letters expressing words that sometimes cannot be spoken and thoughts that need to be shared. Kerry Jones, bereavement services lead at the Mary Stevens Hospice, expressed her hopes for the new service. "Grief is a deeply personal journey, and finding ways to express our feelings can be incredibly healing. Whispers on the Wind is a beautiful and symbolic space for individuals to communicate with those they miss dearly. We hope it brings a sense of peace, connection, and comfort to our community, providing an opportunity for people to release their emotions and honour the memory of their loved ones in a very special way. The Whispers on the Wind postbox is accessible to the public at any time and is free to use. All letters placed in the postbox will be treated with the utmost respect and privacy. The Mary Stevens Hospice is committed to supporting individuals and families through all stages of loss and bereavement. Whispers on the Wind is the latest addition to their comprehensive range of bereavement services, which include supportive listening, bereavement hubs, children and young people services, and remembrance events. Now it's time to test your knowledge, as we have the quiz questions for this edition. Take it away, Roger.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
It's quiz time again, and this is Roger, your quizmaster. On the first quiz is 10 questions on history, mostly British history. Are you ready? I guess none of us were around when some of these events took place, but you may know them anyway. Question 1. During what years was the Crimean War fought? When was the Crimean War? Question 2. Another war question. When was the United States Civil War? Confederates versus the Unionists. Some wore blue and some wore grey, as the song went. U.S. Civil War years, please. And just towards the end of that, question 3. What was the name of the man who shot President Abraham Lincoln? The name of the man who shot President Abraham Lincoln at Ford's Theatre. Question 4. When in the UK was the first universal postage one penny stamp started being in use? When did they introduce the adhesive stamp that was the one penny for universal postage? Apparently some of them are due to arrive any minute now. Question 5. Which humorous magazine started in 1841 in the UK? The humorous magazine that started in 1841. It packed quite a lot of impact. Question 6. Which curious tax was repealed in the United Kingdom in 1851. Which curious tax was repealed in 1851, when the government, as it were, finally saw the light? Question 7. What was Queen Victoria's 1853 birth of her 8th child significant for? For what reason was the birth of Queen Victoria's 8th child in 1853 significant? Question 8. Which hugely famous geographical feature did David Livingstone find in 1855? Not that it was lost, of course, but he found it and named it. Question 9. Where was Britain's first electric tram system? Started in 1891, I think. Where? Which city? And question 10, back to Queen Victoria again. When did Queen Victoria die? In what year did Queen Victoria pass away? Answers later.
TNS Soundings.
Cheers for those questions, Roger. I'll get my mind working on them. Up now, however, is another block of local news. A leading eye health care specialist is urging people with a family history of certain eye conditions to attend regular eye health checks due to a link between inherited genes and an increased risk of potential sight problems. Optegra Eye Hospital in Birmingham reveals that inheriting specific genes can significantly increase your risk of developing conditions such as glaucoma, congenital cataract, and age-related macular degeneration, making routine eye tests vital for early detection and effective treatment. Professor Claire O'Donnell, head of Optometry and Eye Sciences Research Division at Optegra, says, "Many people don't realise that eye conditions like glaucoma can run in families, and that's why it's vital to know your family history. If you have a parent, sibling, or grandparent with an eye condition, it's especially important to have regular annual eye examinations. A regular eye test can detect the condition early, and timely treatment is often the best way to slow its progression whilst reducing the risk of permanent vision loss." Genetic risk. Twin and population studies have shown that having a close relative with glaucoma, particularly primary open-angle glaucoma, POAG, increases your risk of developing the condition. In fact, individuals with a family history of POAG are 4 to 9 times more likely to develop it themselves. Due to glaucoma developing slowly and with no early symptoms, many people don't realise they have it until noticeable vision loss has occurred. It is one of the leading causes of irreversible sight loss in the UK, especially in people over 60. Whilst the causes of age-related macular degeneration, AMD, are currently unknown, researchers do know that the triggers are complex and are related to both hereditary and environmental factors. If you carry specific genes and you have a family history of AMD, then you will have an increased chance of developing the condition yourself. Similarly, family history plays a role in cataract development. Genetic factors can influence the structural integrity of the lens and its susceptibility to cataract formation. If close relatives have had cataracts, an individual may inherit a genetic predisposition that increases their risk. How can regular eye tests help? As part of a regular eye test, which all adults are recommended by the NHS to have at least every 2 years, your optometrist will measure the eye pressure as part of the check for conditions such as glaucoma. They will also examine your eye using ophthalmoscopy to check the fine detail, and this can detect blood vessel leakage and swelling at the back of the eye, a possible sign of diabetes. Eye tests can also detect cataracts even at early stages and check for bleeds at the back of the eye due to high blood pressure or diabetes. By having your eyes regularly checked, optometrists can see changes very early and sometimes start treatment before you notice any changes to the vision. Optegra's tips for protecting your vision. Let your optometrist know about any family history of eye disease. Attend a regular eye test at least every 2 years and more frequently if advised by your optometrist. Beware of any changes in your vision, however minor.
And a Wolverhampton man who was diagnosed with a rare form of blood cancer following a routine eye examination has urged the public to get their eyes checked. Robert Campbell has annual eye examinations due to having glaucoma, but one of his routine checkups turned out to be life-changing. Optometrist Claire Williams from Flint Optometry spotted a number of bleeds at the back of the eye and referred Mr. Campbell to ophthalmology specialists at New Cross Hospital. Following tests, the 67-year-old was diagnosed with Waldenstrom macroglobulinemia, a type of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma that affects the lymphatic system. He said, "My head was all over the place. They said that there was good news and bad news. The good news is that the type of cancer I have is not that aggressive, but the bad news is that you never get rid of it." Mr. Campbell has undergone bone marrow biopsies, blood plasma transfusions, and chemotherapy, with consultants continuing to monitor him. In the months leading up to the eye test, Mr. Campbell experienced pain in his legs, nosebleeds, exhaustion, and blurry vision. He was in the middle of investigations through his GP when his yearly eye appointment with Flint Optometry came up. He said, "I'm one of the lucky ones. I'm living a relatively normal life. My message to people is that if you're feeling at all unwell and you're having problems with your eyes, get your eyes tested. It could save your life." The team at Flint Optometry say they have had a recent spate of life-threatening and serious conditions being detected through eye examinations. Co-company director Edward Lyons says that more regular and better quality eye test examinations has led to more incidents where serious health conditions are detected, demonstrating that eye examinations can be life-saving and sight-saving. Another recent example was a woman who complained about her glasses and spoke about bumping into tables. This red flag conversation prompted an eye examination which showed her periphery vision had declined, and she was later diagnosed with a pituitary brain tumour. The client has had the tumour removed and has recovered. Flint Optometry optometrists also discovered one client had had a stroke following a visual field test. He told staff that he was suffering some memory loss and headaches, which his family initially thought could be due to the start of dementia. His optician picked up on some loss of peripheral vision, which led to an MRI scan that diagnosed a stroke. Mr. Lyons said, "Recently we have seen a real run of clinical issues, which has been positive in that they've been picked up early. Part of it is that more people are having more frequent eye examinations. That, along with having better equipment and spending a bit more time with clients, means that we are finding more pathology. Good quality eye care makes all the difference. It's not just about seeing letters on a chart. A proper eye examination can save your sight or your life. Many of these clients were asymptomatic, so the sooner we find these things, the better. We're now finding pituitary brain tumours about twice a year. They're not as uncommon as you think." Mr. Lyons said that a number of the practice's new clients have only ever had rudimentary eye examinations in the past and have never, for example, had their visual field tested. He said Flint Optometry, which has practices in Tettenhall Road, Codsall and Wensfield, is moving to the gold standard of ensuring that every client has an OCT scan which looks at the health at the back of the eye, which can be revealing. He added, "As well as having better quality diagnostic equipment available, it's about staff having the knowledge to interpret the findings and know what it all means." Now, from sight tests to surgical procedures, and with thanks to TNF Soundings contributors Fiona and Nikki, we can find out details of a quite remarkable type of surgery, tooth in eye surgery, which is helping to restore patients' vision.
Hello, this is Nikki with an article written by Fiona about an innovative way of tackling eyesight problems. Have you ever heard of osteoodontokeratoprosthesis? You can be forgiven if you haven't. It doesn't exactly trip off the tongue easily. More commonly known as tooth-in-eye surgery, it's a procedure to restore the power of sight to blind patients by implanting one of their own teeth into their eye. This unlikely-sounding tooth-in-eye surgery is reserved for cases where a traditional corneal transplant is not possible due to the extent of damage or other complications. It may sound like science fiction, but this innovative type of surgery has a reported success rate of between 88 to 94%, according to reports from around the world. A highly specialized and technical procedure, it is reserved for cases where traditional solutions are not possible due to the amount of damage in the eye or other complications, such as trauma, disease, autoimmune disorders, or multiple failed corneal transplants. It involves using a patient's tooth to anchor an artificial lens, restoring their ability to perceive light and shapes, or even to regain partial or full vision. The idea was first developed in Rome in the early 1960s by an ophthalmic surgeon named Professor Benedetto Strampelli. So how does it work? And now here's the science bit. A tooth is extracted from the patient and a small rectangular portion is shaved off it. This portion then has a small hole drilled through it to hold a clear acrylic lens called an optical cylinder. This tiny rectangular portion of tooth acts as a frame to hold the cylinder. The tooth cylinder combination is planted into the patient's cheek to allow soft tissue to grow around it, a process which may take up to 4 months. In the final stage, surgeons create a pocket in the patient's eye using tissue from the cheek, and the tooth lens unit is carefully transplanted to the eye with the optical cylinder positioned to align with the pupil. Over time, blood vessels integrate with the implant, stabilizing it and reducing the risk of rejection. Eventually, following this process, light is able to go through the acrylic lens, allowing the patient to see through their eye again with improved vision, effectively replacing the damaged cornea.
So why a tooth? Since the tooth comes from the patient's own body, there is virtually no risk of rejection, which is a common problem with corneal or artificial implants. Also, as a tooth is durable, it provides a strong foundation for the artificial lens, making it less prone to dislodging.
Of course, as with all complex surgery, there are drawbacks to the tooth-in-eye procedure. Not all ophthalmologists are qualified to perform it, which can limit accessibility. In addition, a long recovery period will require specialist aftercare to ensure the health of the implant. The procedure won't heal or replace the optic nerve or retina, so it's not a miracle cure for all forms of blindness. Also, the patient's eye will not look like a natural eye after surgery, which some people, including the patient, may find challenging. It will be flesh pink due to the transplanted tissue and will have a small dark hole in the middle where the optical cylinder presents a new window for light to enter. In spite of its complexity, the length of time taken to complete the surgery and ongoing aftercare, tooth-in-eye surgery offers a lifeline to patients who would otherwise remain blind due to being unsuitable candidates for traditional treatments. Tooth-in-eye surgery is performed in the UK, Canada, India, Japan, and Germany. Speaking to CTV in Canada shortly before undergoing the procedure and asked by the interviewer how he feels about how his eye will look afterwards, tooth-in-eye patient Brent Chapman, who has been blind since the age of 13, said, "You take function over appearance. I have a whole bucket list of things I want to do when I can see again." So hats off to Professor Benedetto Strampelli and his strange but effective stroke of inspiration.
TNF Soundings.
Time now to hit the tracks for a railway adventure with our railway enthusiast, David Smith, as we begin a mini-series all about the famous steam engine that made a triumphant return to Severn Valley Railway this summer. The Flying Scotsman is the most famous steam engine of all, and it is the star attraction at the Severn Valley Railway. But what is it that makes the Flying Scotsman so special? Here, courtesy of the National Rail Museum and read by David Smith, is the potted history of this magnificent piece of engineering.
The Flying Scotsman started life as just another of Sir Nigel Gresley's A1 class of locomotives. It was built in Doncaster in 1923 with a cost of just under £8,000. It was the first locomotive of the newly formed London and North Eastern Railway, LNER, and went into service in February 1923 with the number 1472. By 1924, when it was selected to appear at the British Empire Exhibition in London, the loco had been renumbered 4472 and given the name Flying Scotsman after the daily 10 a.m. London to Edinburgh rail service, which started in 1862. The British Empire Exhibition made Flying Scotsman famous, and it went on to feature in many more publicity events for the LNER. In 1928, it was given a new type of tender with a corridor, which meant that a new crew could take over without stopping the train. This allowed it to haul the first ever non-stop London to Edinburgh service on the 1st of May that year, reducing the journey time to 8 hours. In 1934, Scotsman was clocked at 100 mph on a special test run, officially the first locomotive in the UK to reach that speed. The test run proved to the LNER's directors that steam power could provide high speeds, negating the plan for the company to use diesel power on its high speed services. LNER passenger locomotives had always been painted apple green, but during the Second World War, Flying Scotsman was repainted in wartime black, in common with all railway stock. After the war, it became green again and was rebuilt as an A3 Pacific. In 1948, British Railways was formed and rail travel in Britain was nationalised, Scotsman, now renumbered 60103, was painted blue for a time, then BR Green. It remained this colour until 1963, when it was retired by British Rail. By this time, it had undergone several alterations to improve its performance, but it had been pulling trains for 40 years and steam engines were becoming old-fashioned. In January 1963, Alan Pegler bought Flying Scotsman. As part of the deal, Pegler negotiated a complete overhaul of the locomotive. It was converted back to single chimney condition and repainted in LNER livery. The tender was exchanged for a corridor type and an agreement made that enabled it to run on the main line. In a blaze of publicity, Flying Scotsman ran its last train for British Railways on the 14th of January 1963. In May 1968, on the 40th anniversary of the first non-stop run, Flying Scotsman travelled non-stop from London King's Cross to Edinburgh.
Next up, we have another block of local news.
Last Friday, August 15th, the Royal British Legion, in partnership with the government, held the national commemorative event to mark the 80th anniversary of VJ Day and the end of the Second World War. King Charles II and the Queen Consort were both in attendance in Orrawa, Staffordshire, for the commemoration, as were several veterans of VJ Day. In that group of survivors were two men who served with the British Navy during the war, 100-year-old Bob Gelder and 100-year-old Bill Redston, both from Wolverhampton. Redston, a Wolves fan from Tettenhall, turned 100 in November and asked people to make donations to the Arboretum as a present to him. The centenarian was part of the D-Day invasion of Normandy, with his motor launch escorting a convoy of essential supply vessels to Utah Beach the day after it had been captured by US troops. He joined the Royal Navy Coastal Forces as a commissioned officer when he was just 18, and a few months later he became First Lieutenant on motor launch ML-191, where he served throughout the Second World War. After D-Day, Bill and his motor launch sailed to Rangoon in Burma, where he spent the rest of the war patrolling the Irrawaddy River, searching the jungle for Japanese soldiers. Once the war ended in the Far East, he spent some time in Singapore in charge of Japanese prisoners of war before returning to the UK in 1946. The Arboretum, NMA, has always been a place close to Bill's heart, and he has attended major commemoration days there, including VJ Day 75 in 2020, where he met the then Prince Charles, and D-Day 80 earlier this year, where he met the Duke of Edinburgh, and was one of only 26 D-Day veterans present on the day. He also received the Legion d'Honneur Medal for his services on D-Day at the Arboretum in 2021, which he described as one of the proudest moments of his life. Friday's commemoration featured 400 members of the armed forces and included music performances, readings and veteran testimonies, as well as a flypast from the Red Arrows and historic aircraft from the Battle of Britain Memorial Flight. Paying tribute to all those who served in the Far East and the Pacific, a national two-minute silence was observed at midday, followed by a one-hour commemoration at the base of the Armed Forces Memorial.
And another legacy of courage, resilience and quiet heroism for a former Wolverhampton Wanderers player who served in the Far East and Pacific can be told to honour Arthur Titch Walker. Born on the 25th of August 1919 in Wolverhampton, Arthur Titch Walker was the youngest of 16 children. His early life was marked by hardship. His father died when he was very young, and Arthur began working in a factory making taps, earning the nickname Titch because he had to stand on a box to reach the machine. Before the war, Arthur was a promising amateur footballer, even playing for Wolverhampton Wanderers. But his life changed dramatically with the outbreak of World War II. He joined the Royal Artillery Scots Regiment as a signaller and was soon sent to Lanark to help train the Lanarkshire Yeomanry, which became the 155th Lancashire Yeomanry Field Regiment RA. While stationed in Lanark, Arthur met Ruby McIntyre and they married on the 15th of March 1941. Just days later, Arthur was deployed to fight in Malaya, where he was eventually captured and became a prisoner of war. The Hell of Kinkaseki. Arthur was interned in the Kinkaseki copper mine in Taiwan, one of the most brutal POW camps under Japanese control. Starvation, beatings, and relentless forced labour defined daily life. Arthur survived nearly 4 years in captivity, enduring unimaginable suffering. In November 1945, he was moved to Taihoku POW camp, and after liberation, he returned home via Australia. The journey home wasn't easy for Arthur, who caught tuberculosis, leading to his left lung being removed whilst on board the ship home. In a letter dated 25th of September 1945, Arthur wrote, "After 3 years of starvation, it is certainly great to get what you want without worrying when you're going to get the next." His words, filled with warmth and humour, asked after his family, Sophie, Den and Little Fat Pat, whom he'd fondly remembered performing acrobatics on the kitchen table. A coin for courage. Decades later, Arthur received a commemorative coin from the Kinkaseki Memorial Committee, a symbol of honour for his resilience. He treasured it deeply. "I was overjoyed to be given the coin, and I will always treasure it, because we have never received anything from this government except a war pension." The coin and the monument erected at the former campsite in Chinigwashi, Taiwan, stand as testaments to the endurance of men like Arthur. Life after war. After the war, Arthur returned to Lanark and worked selling fruit and vegetables from a horse and cart. He was later offered a job bagging coal at the railway sidings, but had to decline due to tuberculosis. Eventually, he moved back to Wolverhampton, where he worked as a van driver for the Cooperative Society and later joined the British Seafruits and Ennis. Arthur passed away in May 1998, leaving behind his beloved wife Ruby, daughters Maria and Margaret, son Robert and 4 grandchildren. His legacy lives on through them and through the wonderful, powerful story of survival and courage he carried with him. Lest we forget. Arthur's story is one among many. 8 other West Midlands men were reported missing in Malaya, likely prisoners of war. Arthur's survival gave voice to their silence. On this VJ Day 2025, we honour Arthur Titch Walker, a man whose quiet heroism continues to inspire. His resilience, love of family, and enduring spirit remind us of the sacrifices made for peace. Arthur signed off his wartime letter with affection and humour. "Give my love to all our family. I'll give you a few bedtime thrillers and we'll celebrate in a big way." His words remind us that behind every soldier is a family waiting, a life interrupted, and a story that must be told. Arthur Walker's story is one of quiet heroism, enduring love, and the unbreakable spirit of a man who never stopped believing in home. Up now we have to hear what the weather has in store for us. Brought to us, come rain or shine, by our own Sunny Mina.
Hi everyone, it's Mina here with your forecast for the week ahead. Well, after this week's mini heatwave bringing about another sunny, warm and dry spell of weather, this week is set to have a much more familiar feel, with it becoming a little more unsettled. In result, the high UV levels we've been experiencing shall become a little more varied, with levels ranging from medium to high, as the unbroken sunshine shall be replaced with more intermittent rain showers. The sunrise and sunset times are 6:05 a.m. for the sunrise and 8:15 p.m. for the sunset. As for the weather, the spell of sunny intervals that we've had over the past few days look like it shall remain for a little while longer, as it continues on Friday 22nd of August and into the weekend on Saturday 23rd. The wind will become more refreshing too, with a light suddenly helping to keep temperatures at something more recognisable and comfortable for this time of year at around 23 degrees. However, things look set to change as we head into Sunday with a band of rain moving in across the region. And it's looking like an unsettled spell of sunshine and rain showers shall remain with us as we progress through the week, with some scattered showers and sunny spells expected on Monday 25th and Tuesday 26th of August. With a more moderate southwesterly breeze, temperatures will also become noticeably cooler, with highs of just 19 degrees in places. The rain will become much more persistent as we move into Wednesday 27th and Thursday 28th of August, with long spells of rain and potential thunderstorms expected right across the region. The southwesterly breeze shall remain, meaning temperatures will remain 20 degrees. So, there we have it, a real mixed bag of weather coming up this week. It's almost like the weather knows it's bank holiday weekend ahead. Do take care, have a wonderful week, and enjoy the weather.
Now it's time to find out how our local football teams have been getting on.
Albion's 3-2 victory away at Wrexham not only put Albion into the top three of the Championship for the time being, but banished some unwanted statistics. Isaac Price netted a goal in each half, while Jed Wallace added another as Albion won away, made it back-to-back wins, and kicked off the season with two victories. In the process, they banished some unwanted statistics. Away day blues are over. Albion's away form over recent years has been the subject of debate. Last season, it was certainly under the microscope because it was so poor, and for some, it was one of the big reasons for their decline late in the season. In fact, heading into the Wrexham clash, they had not won in their last 15 away games. The run dated back to Hull last season in November, which was one of only four away victories. Now they've ended that. Back to back. The issue of momentum and being unable to string a run together last season was also something that came in for scrutiny. After starting like a steam train with four wins from five, the momentum deserted them. Albion lost the ability to put back-to-back victories together. They just couldn't do it. However, that's ended now. The two victories are the first back-to-back victories since wins over Portsmouth and Plymouth in September last year. 8-year-long stat. One statistic that some may not be aware of is starting the season with two wins. Everyone wants to nail down a decent start, and Albion have done that. And in the process, they've broken an 8-year run, not since the 2017-18 campaign, which was a season that saw Albion relegated, have Albion won the first two games of their new campaign. And it's from 2018 that Wolves' astonishing August record in the Premier League has read more like a horror novel. As since 2018, Wolves have played 17 matches across the August months, losing 10 and winning just one. So, how did they fare on their 18th match against a rejuvenated and recharged Manchester City? Much the same, unfortunately, as Vitor Pereira's side lost the game 4-0. But the result was perhaps not befitting of the performance from the team, as Wolves looked threatening during lengthy periods before eventually succumbing to Manchester City's quality. The football, arguably, was secondary, as the importance of the curtain raiser was more around paying tribute to one of their former favourites more than anything else. The day was about Diogo Jota. The tributes were fitting, the fans and the club doing themselves proud.
Now, here come the quiz answers.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, Roger back again with the answers to my history quiz. Question 1. The answer, the Crimean War, was fought between 1854 and 1856. Question 2. The United States Civil War was fought between 1861 and 1865, which led us into question 3 about who shot President Abraham Lincoln in Ford's Theatre just towards the end of that war. Well, it was an actor called John Wilkes Booth, who was, I never knew this before, read this, but John Wilkes Booth was actually tracked down and shot later. But he was easy to spot because he was such a well-known actor, apparently, that his picture was known by lots of people. The price of fame, you see. Question 4. The penny stamp, was that the penny black? I don't know that, but it was the first universal postage stamp introduced into the United Kingdom. It was 1840. 1840. Question 5. The humorous magazine that was started in 1841 packed quite a punch. Punch was the name of that magazine. Question 6. The curious tax that was repealed in 1851 was the window tax, which led, of course, to lots of buildings around, very old buildings, you can see them, where the windows were bricked in to avoid that tax. Question 7. Queen Victoria in 1853 gave birth to her 8th child, and she used chloroform to ease the pain. Chloroform, which was not in wide use, and she was a great advocate for it and let it be known that she had taken advantage of its use. Question 8. The famous huge geographical feature in Africa that David Livingstone, I presume, found the Victoria Falls, after good Queen Victoria, of course. Question 9. Leeds here in Yorkshire, was where Britain's first electric tram system began operating in 1891. And question 10, back to good Queen Victoria. She died in 1901. How did you do? Better than me, I bet.
TNS Soundings.
Hopefully, our gardening experts at MK Pulse magazine have a relaxing selection of tips for the month ahead, as up next, we have our gardening section full of advice on how to get your garden ready.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
This is Jan with some seasonal tips and ideas from the gardening expert at the MK Pulse magazine.
I have always loved the mystery and beauty of a pond. Today I appreciate their calming appeal and the way they support our wildlife. As a youngster, I loved watching tadpoles and froglets darting around, peering into the underwater life. Only recently, I spent ages sitting at the side of a pond watching the juvenile frogs on their journey, and I recently enjoyed the delights of my friend Nicky's charming country garden. Bees were still gathering the last of the pollen for the day, butterflies danced among the blossoms, and birds arrived to drink and bathe as the heat retreated on the hottest day of the year. Ponds are a great way to improve outdoor spaces, but as with any home improvement, you'll need to do your homework before constructing this garden feature. Will your pond be lined with waterproof material or concrete? What shape will it be? And where is the best place for it? Constructing under the shade of a tree is a bad move, with fallen leaves guaranteed to bring problems. Do your research and take your time. You don't want to rush and regret later. Ponds are a fantastic way to welcome frogs, toads, and newts to your garden. Plants around the edge will provide shelter and security for the amphibians, and they look aesthetically pleasing. Of course, froggies aren't the only creatures you might welcome. The common pond skater, water snails, water beetles, water boatmen, and dragonfly larvae are among the many invertebrates that will likely be spotted. Nicky and Andy's pond was wisely created with shelves at different depths when they built it 20 years ago. There was a fair bit of aquatic soil added prior to the pond being filled with water and plants, Andy said. This ensured the plants would spread naturally without being confined to pots. We made sure there was a good circulation of water with no dead spots within it. We don't overfilter it because we don't have too many fish.
Nikki added, this allowed us to add in a mix of mostly native planting and marginals. We have bulrush, flowering rush, marsh marigold, iris, water mint, water forget-me-not, and water lilies, to name just a few plants. The pond is also home to a surprisingly large population of newts, toads, water boatmen, and the occasional frog, and is a haven for dragonflies and damselflies, as well as providing bathing and drinking facilities for a multitude of garden birds. I love the way the pond's inhabitants and plants change over the seasons. It needs a good tidy up once every few months, and the water levels topping up in very hot weather, but is relatively easy to look after now it's established. One word of warning though, don't dash out next spring to bring in spawn from another pond to your new water feature. It's an easy way to bring in disease. Instead, sit back and let nature take its course. The growing season is well underway, but it's not too late to sow some seeds. Quite a few vegetables and flowers thrive if sown in August. Even if you only have a windowsill, why not sow some pea shoots, as served in the best restaurants? They only take a week or so to sprout, and you harvest them by cutting and then letting them grow back for a second cut, before sowing a new batch. They are delicious in stir fries and salads, but don't let them grow too big or they will taste bitter. More culinary crops to try are rocket, cress, coriander, green aroma, basil, dill, and cut-and-come-again salad leaves. If you have space in an outdoor plot, the choice is even greater. Now is the time to sow hardy annuals that survive our winter, such as pot marigolds and cornflowers. Also, try biennials that flower in their second year, such as sweet williams and wallflowers, forget-me-nots and foxgloves. If you already have foxgloves in the garden, choose Sutton's Apricot or Pam's Choice to add to the colour palette. Edibles to sow at this time are all the plants in the cabbage family, such as cauliflower and kohlrabi, plus radishes, turnips, beetroots, spring onions and carrots. Leafy vegetables for winter harvesting, which can also be sown now, are spinach, lettuce and Swiss chard. Try the Bright Lights variety. It does what it says on the tin.
TNF Soundings.
So that's it for another edition of the Black Country Talking News. A reminder to our CD listeners who have received CDs in padded envelopes that you don't need to send anything back to us. If you have a sight loss tip or someone you would like to wish a happy birthday to, just say hello to. Maybe even a poem or talking book you would like reviewed, then please get in touch with us at the Beacon Centre. Call 01902 880111. Email bctn@beaconvision.org or write to us at the Black Country Talking News, Beacon, Wolverhampton Road East, Wolverhampton, WV4 6AZ. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you for listening, and thank you to all our supporters, donators and volunteers who without their support we would be unable to run this free service. Please note the information and views expressed in this recording does not necessarily represent the views of Beacon or Talking News and were accurate at the time of recording. Mentions of goods and services does not imply endorsement, and whilst every care is taken to supply accurate information, Beacon and Talking News do not undertake liability for any errors. So it's goodbye from all of us, stay safe, have a good week, and we look forward to bringing you next week's edition of the Black Country Talking News. Ta-ra!